OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Get the full show straight to your phone by subscribing to the OTB AM podcast wherever you get yours. The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
But now, delighted to say we are going to talk Chelsea Spurs, and Liam Toomey of The Athletic joins us on the line. Good morning to you, Liam.
Good morning.
We've just been debating the rights and wrongs of Jose's system last night. It wasn't pretty to look at.
No, it wasn't. I think Tottenham's contempt for the ball in the first half was quite startling, even by Mourinho's standards. And while in the second half, you know, it did look like Chelsea were hanging on a little bit, particularly in the last 20 minutes. I think a lot of people would probably say that Tottenham didn't deserve an equaliser for the way that they approached the game initially. I mean, it was always going to be a difficult one for them without Harry Kane, who clearly is a big part of their attacking system. But Chelsea's level of control shouldn't really happen at Tottenham Stadium the way that it did.
Is conversely, Harry Kane being out the thing that keeps Jose Mourinho in the job for the next while? Like, he's fourth favourite in that market to get the sack, and everybody's assuming once Harry Kane comes back that everything gets fixed again, at least for a little while. Is that the thing that keeps Jose in a job for the next while?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, Kane and Son have been fantastic this year, haven't they? And they've kind of almost double-handedly justified the defensive strategy that Mourinho has taken, because they've made it work at the other end of the pitch. And judging by what Mourinho said after the game, Kane won't be out for too much longer. He might even be back for Tottenham's next match. So that will probably buy Mourinho a little bit more time. I think the other thing that's buying him a little bit more time is that there are empty stadiums. I think he was very lucky that Tottenham Stadium was empty last night, because I don't get the impression that Tottenham fans, particularly not the ones I was seeing on social media, would have tolerated that kind of first half performance in particular against their bitter rivals if they'd been there in person. So yeah, that could buy him a little bit of time, but there's no doubt he's under pressure now.
Yeah, like, I mean, when you look at it, you step back and take a look at the big picture. Six last season, they're well off the top four at the minute. They've been beaten by teams at all ends of the season. They've three losses on the bounce. Is there a point when you start to look at some of those players, like mentioned Harry Kane and Son, and there are others in there as well, you know, he's failing to get the best out of Matt Doherty, that there was something of a deal about made, obviously, having been signed in the close season. At what point do some of those players start to look at it, Liam, and think, I'm actually, if you know, the longer Jose is here, the less likely it is that I am?
Yeah, I think there are quite a few senior players in that squad that have big decisions to make in the next year or two. I mean, someone like Toby Alderweireld has already been at Tottenham a lot longer than all of us expected, given that he seemed perennially in a contract standoff. And Harry Kane has made noises on numerous occasions about wanting to compete for the biggest trophies. And it looks like Tottenham are heading away from that, not towards it. I mean, you could argue they had a bigger choice to make before they sacked Pochettino and appointed Mourinho, of whether they wanted to refresh this squad or change the manager. And they, of course, chose to change Pochettino for Mourinho, because that's always cheaper than selling a load of players and replacing them. But they do look a slightly tired and stale team now. Certainly don't look like they're anywhere near as dynamic as they were at the peak of their cycle under Poch. So Tottenham have some bigger picture questions to answer, I think. Chelsea won't really worry about that, because they're finally getting some momentum back.
Can I just ask you one more on Tottenham, and we move on to Chelsea after that? Listened to Glenn Hoddle even in the commentary last night, and he's talking about how Tottenham are set up, and how the system's all about defending effectively, and they've forgotten what to do, I think might have been his exact words, once they get the ball, which is a remarkable indictment. Even when they went behind remarkably, they were playing very deep. So is there a sense that, like, once Harry Kane comes back, that all gets fixed. Because like even when you look at it last night, poor Vinicius up front was really not seeing very much of the ball at any point. Does that fix it in your view, Liam? And or yeah, do we suddenly start to see a slightly different style? Would we have seen a different style, I suppose, from Spurs last night if he was there, and how all that plays out?
I don't think we would have seen a markedly different style, judging by the way Tottenham have approached other big games this season. I just think it would have worked better because Harry Kane has adapted his game almost to make a style like this a little bit more possible for Mourinho over the last year or two. He's become very, very good at dropping deep, basically serving as the team's de facto number 10. Getting the ball on the half turn and playing those brilliant passes in behind to Son. And that was clearly the link that they were missing last night, because they were getting the ball out against Chelsea. Not really doing a great job of beating Chelsea's press, but that was partly because they didn't have anyone like Kane who could pick that pass, sometimes with not much space in which to do it. So I think it probably will work better once Kane is back, and it probably would have worked better against Chelsea last night with Kane there. They might have even got an equaliser, but overall you have to think, is a style like that really viable in a game like that? I mean, Tottenham needed to win as well. They shouldn't have been playing for a draw. You know, both of these teams are trying to chase top four spots, and you know, Liverpool, Man City, Man United, and even Leicester, given the way they're playing, all look pretty good for a top four finish right now. So Chelsea and Spurs are under pressure. They should have been looking to win that game.
Liam, you mentioned Tottenham's allergy to possession last night. Chelsea have certainly shown the opposite over the first few games of Thomas Tuchel's reign. The big challenge that has presented itself early is turning that possession into lots of chances. How close did they come to realising that last night?
Yeah, I think Tuchel's first priority on taking this job has been to establish control for this team in a way that was lacking really in the final weeks under Frank Lampard. And he's restored the Jorginho Kovacic axis in midfield, which kind of changes the whole identity of this team, really. And Chelsea have done a very good job of controlling games against very defensive-minded opponents in these first three games with Tuchel. The one thing that's been missing has been the consistent chance creation. And I think they had dangerous moments last night. I think there were a lot of moments against Tottenham where they put Tottenham into difficulty defensively, but the final pass was just really badly lacking, or the final decision in the final third was just not accurate enough or just plain wrong. And I think that's partly the players trying to get used to what Tuchel is asking them to do, get used to this new tactical framework. But it's also because I think Chelsea have a lot of slightly younger players in the final third, and you probably have to live with some bad decisions and a lack of ruthlessness at times as part of that as well. So broadly, I think that there are good signs under Tuchel in terms of the process of what they're doing. But then they're not quite as ruthless as you would like them to be just yet, and it made for quite a nervy finish for them against Tottenham.
And there are a wealth of options for them when it comes to these players in creative positions. It does seem that Mason Mount has put his hand up highest in the first couple of games as a player who was going to play in roughly a number 10 position. I saw him describe his position last night as a false nine dropping into a 10. Is there a possibility he plays as a singular number 10 going forward for Chelsea?
Yeah, he might start getting the reputation as Thomas Tuchel's son now. he's certainly capable of doing that. You know, I think he's shown in the last two games in particular, the two that he started, a real talent for finding space between the defensive lines, even of very deep-lying opponents, which is not an easy thing to do. And then playing on the half turn, when he's getting those passes from Jorginho and Kovacic, and really setting the table for Chelsea to trouble teams in the final third. He's kind of one of the people that you come back to when you're talking about decision-making at times, not being absolutely perfect, but he is only 22 and he's still developing as a player as well. I'd say the one thing that maybe could be an obstacle to him being the kind of undisputed number 10 of this team, is that, you know, you have Kai Havertz, who Chelsea have a massive investment in at a club level, and was a big, you know, was a significant reason for the coaching change in the end, his form this season. You also have Hakim Ziyech, who in this system at least makes more sense as an attacking midfield creator rather than one of the wide players. So there are plenty of options, and I think Tuchel's reputation suggests that he won't go with any one player in every single game. But what is clear is that Mount has put himself in position with his early performances to make himself important to Tuchel, just as he was to Lampard.
The price tag of Havertz is a really interesting point to bring up. And I do wonder, and you might be able to shed some light on this, if there is this underlying pressure on the Chelsea manager to reflect the price tag with a few extra minutes here and there. We've spent so much money, so therefore we must play the guy. And also on top of that, I wonder, does that give a different sort of pressure to their recruitment strategy this summer? You're going to have someone like Erling Haaland being linked with every club over the next few months. It makes sense for Manchester City to go into the transfer market for him. And it also kind of makes sense for Chelsea to be interested in him, given the lack of goals or the problems they've had. The issue, though, is that they've spent a hell of a lot of money already on attacking players. Will that come into their thinking this summer if they want to get into the mix for Erling Haaland?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, on the price tag front, I mean, that's certainly a factor in the way that the club think about Havertz and the decisions they make and the way they talk to the coach. But that's not just Havertz. That's any player that they've spent an awful lot of money in, I mean, Kepa is a similar issue where we, as part of the big story we ran on Frank Lampard sacking, you know, one of the details was he kind of gave up on Kepa towards the end of last season and was told by the club, oh, you should put an arm around him, work with him, try and get the best out of him. Because when you pay that much for a player, there is a commitment at the club level to give them absolutely every chance, even when it's clear that they're not living up to expectations. So that's the kind of situation. Obviously, Havertz is not a Kepa situation. He's not been at Chelsea very long, but he has that kind of investment at club level. In terms of Haaland, yeah, he does make sense as a target, primarily because he's so damn good. He's the best number nine. You know, he could be the best number nine of his generation based on what he's done early in his career. And I think even with the attacking weapons that Chelsea already have, I think, you know, Timo Werner's a lot better than he's shown. I think Tammy Abraham has a lot of room to grow as a player. If you have a chance to get a player like Erling Haaland, I think you have to go for it. Because if you don't get him, one of your rivals will, and he could define the next 10 years of European football. So you just kind of try and get a player like that and worry about the rest later. But he will have his pick, whether he leaves Dortmund this summer or the following summer when his release clause actually kicks in. He will have his pick of elite European clubs, I'm sure.
One last one for me anyway, Liam, on this last couple of weeks. You mentioned your coverage of the Lampard sacking, and I guess you've had a front row seat to how Lampard and his demise eventually unfolded over the last few weeks. Do you ever see a situation in the coming seasons where a club legend can be given that opportunity again at Chelsea? I know John Terry's gone into coaching, and there is always going to be talk again once Thomas Tuchel's time is up at Chelsea about Lampard perhaps coming back as a coach, not necessarily as manager at the club. Do you think that the relationship between the club and their club legends has changed as a result of the Lampard reign?
It's an interesting question. I don't think you can ever say never with Chelsea. Purely because I didn't think Mourinho would come back. It seemed like those relationships were too strained. But time heals all wounds, and it might take a few years. I mean, what I can say with relative certainty or relative confidence is that I don't think a manager as unproven as Lampard was, or as inexperienced as Lampard was, will get the job again now. Because those were such unique circumstances at Chelsea with the transfer ban, Eden Hazard leaving. They were at a unique point where they weren't quite as attractive to proven coaches as they usually are. And that was a big part of the reason why Lampard ended up rising to the top of the list. I think if Lampard wants the job again, and we'll see whether he does or not, he will have to go away and prove himself elsewhere now. And kind of establish that body of work that Thomas Tuchel has, you know, and every other name who was linked with this job to replace him. So I don't think it rules out a club legend. I don't necessarily get the sense that club legends have been put off the Chelsea job. I think it's still a very attractive job in lots of ways. It's just a very difficult job, politically as well as the sporting challenge. But I'm sure whether it was, you know, John Terry or Petr Cech or Didier Drogba or any of the names from Chelsea's golden era, I'm sure if they had those kind of coaching ambitions, Chelsea would be a uniquely attractive job to them in the way that it was to Lampard.
I did also mean to ask you, Liam, about Lampard's parting gift to you personally, a fair blunt appraisal of your coverage of him as Chelsea manager. What was the fallout to that like as a writer? Did you find that your Chelsea fan followers were all on Lampard's side? Did you feel you had good backup at that point, given things weren't going so well for Lampard? What were those few days like in the aftermath of that press conference?
To be honest, I didn't enjoy the few days. Not because, you know, I didn't take what Lampard said personally. It wasn't an issue for me at all. The only thing that I didn't enjoy was just how big an issue everyone else made of it. I think if it had happened in a non-televised section of the press conference, most people wouldn't have even heard about it, because I wouldn't have made a big deal out of it. I don't think anyone at Chelsea would have said anything. It was just one of those surreal situations. And the fact then that Lampard, you know, got sacked only a few days later and he was who he was at Chelsea, it just made for about a week or two of pretty bad toxicity on Chelsea Twitter. It can get that way sometimes, but it was, yeah, not the best few days. And it certainly wasn't a story that I enjoyed covering, because you don't want to cover a club sacking their greatest ever player. But it, you know, we were reporting the situation as it was, and Lampard was under pressure, and that was it, really. So it's not something that lingers with me. I didn't have an issue with it at the time. I don't now. It's just one of those times where you maybe switch off Twitter for a little while and wait for it all to die down.
That's never a bad idea. Was there ever any contact afterwards, Liam, from Frank Lampard himself or the club, or was that just it?
No. Like I said, I mean, it wasn't an issue. We had a professional disagreement in a press conference, which people happened to see. I wasn't expecting anything, and there's been no contact.
Can I ask you one last question? Because you've seen them up close and personal. On the bank of evidence from what you've seen from Frank Lampard, we've been discussing it on the show a little bit over the last couple of weeks. What level is he, do you think? Like, where will he find his level?
It's hard to say, because he'd had so little time coaching before he got the Chelsea job. And I think he did some good things in the Chelsea job beyond giving the young players a chance. I think he had some pretty good tactical moments last year and some pretty good tactical wins. The problem was, once things started to go wrong, because he didn't have that track record, there was nothing to convince the people above him that he was going to turn it around. So I think with time, he certainly strikes me as the type of character that can be a big success in coaching, because the same things that turned him into the greatest player in Chelsea's history, that drive and dedication, that intelligence, and, you know, that desire to improve every day and kind of analyze your own weaknesses, I think will serve him really well in coaching. Those are the things that tend to separate the best coaches, or the ones that mature into the best coaches over time. It just might take a few years. And I think a big part of the success of coaching as well is picking the right jobs at the right times. And he couldn't turn down the Chelsea job when he got offered it. But this next job is probably quite important to him in terms of making sure he comes in and works with the right owner in the right environment, where he knows he's going to get a little bit of time to build something. And I'm sure he will do that. I'm sure he will be patient and kind of assess his options. But I think as long as he does do those things, I don't see any reason why he can't prove himself to be a high-level coach. And I'm sure, given the way his experience at Chelsea panned out, he'll have more of a burning desire than ever to prove himself so, because that's just the way Lampard works.
Yeah, we'll watch it with interest. Liam, thanks a million for taking the call.
Thanks, guys.
OTB. AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.